Hi, and welcome to the Internet of Humans. I'm Konstantinos Komaitis.
And I'm Jillian York.
Today, we are beyond excited to have with us Meredith Whittaker. For anyone who doesn't know who Meredith is, she's the president of the Signal Foundation. She is also the current chief advisor and the former faculty director and co-founder of the AI Now Institute. Her research and advocacy focus on the social implications of artificial intelligence and the tech industry responsible for it, with a particular emphasis on power and the political economy driving the commercialization of computational technology. Prior to founding AI Now, she worked at Google for over a decade. She has advised the White House, the FCC, FTC, the City of New York, the European Parliament, and many other governments and civil society organizations on artificial intelligence, internet policy, measurement, privacy, and security. Meredith, welcome. It is great to have you with us, and thank you so much for coming.
It's a delight to be here. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with Signal. This tiny organization, has become synonymous with digital privacy in the public's imagination. Can you walk us a little bit? How did this happen? What does Signal do that other similar apps do not?
Well, I think, Jillian would likely be as prepared to answer this question as I am, given that the context in which we first met over a decade ago was in rooms where we were talking about how to achieve meaningful privacy for digital communications and other digital activities in a context of commercialized surveillance. So this is not a new problem. You can go back to the 1970s when concerns over computational databases were sort of underwriting a debate around privacy and human rights and civil liberties. You then go into the 80s and the 90s and the commercialization of networked computation, which, to put it loosely, kind of interconnected many of these databases and birthed the surveillance advertising business model, which we may have won encryption in the late 90s in the crypto wars, but we lost privacy insofar as we opened the floodgates for unlimited commercial surveillance. So that's the context within which the conversations that Jillian and myself and many other people, including Signal founder Moxie Marlinspike, were sort of discussing privacy at that time. And Signal was it was a very competent kind of hypothesis project that then grew into a functional messaging application. And the kind of coup came in 2013 when the Signal protocol was released, which marked a significant advance in, I would say, the history of applied cryptography, and enabled private messaging on mobile devices to much more easily and much more ubiquitously. Then move forward from 2013 on, and you have WhatsApp completing the integration of the Signal protocol to keep the contents of messages private in 2016. And that was a very meaningful kind of pushback against the ubiquitous surveillance business model that is kind of defines our digital lives right now. And that kind of tees us up for some of the attacks on encryption and the attacks on privacy that we're now experiencing. But that's a very quick potted history. We can say succinctly, Signal is the most widely used truly private messaging app on the planet. It's a very small organization with a very outsized reach and influence. I'm very happy to be here because I think it's one of the few actually cool tech organizations. And given that that's where my training is, that's where I focus. So Jillian, I would also love to hear kind of your take on that, given that I think we, our lives have run, been orbiting similar suns.
Absolutely. I mean, I can say that, when Meredith and I met, which I think I'm remembering correctly, was either around or before 2013. I remember the first time we properly hung out was in Tunisia at an event where a lot of really big fans of Signal were there. And this was, again, I think right around the time of the release of the Signal protocol, but even before that, I'm sure you were too. And we were both using Signal's predecessor, TechSecure, which, offered, I don't recall to which degree it offered end-to-end encryption, but it offered much better encryption than any prior messaging service had. And that was such a big deal because you know, for the folks that we were working with in various parts of the world, myself, mostly in the Middle East and North Africa, as our listeners know, end-to-end encryption was just such a necessary development at a time when these governments were figuring out more ways of conducting surveillance on their citizens, following in the lead, of course, of countries like the US, which had been doing it for quite some time, as we may not have even realized at that point. I think this development has led to a much safer experience for so many people. And of course, you know, it also, as you mentioned, triggered the output of more tools that are meant for this purpose and more tools that provide more secure messaging to people. But I do want to just pause on that for a second and say that, you know, I think before Signal, cryptography was really reserved for techies. I know, for me, like before Signal, I was using PGP, which is, and frankly, I mean, I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings, but remains a nightmare for a lot of people to use. It's just difficult. It's difficult to install, difficult to understand. And so, I think now most people have heard of end-to-end encryption thanks to Signal and these other tools. But for the audience who might not be as aware, how would you describe the value of end-to-end encryption?
Well, it maintains the long-standing, you know, hundreds of thousands of years norm of human communication being private in a world where, without our consent or really, you know, holistic understanding, our activities, our lives, our identities, our social networks, our jobs, et cetera, have become the, you know, objects of commercialized surveillance. And of course, commercial surveillance is also, you know, the osmotic layer between commercial and government surveillance is sometimes almost non-existent. So we have to recognize that as a you know, kind of combined nexus and not pit them against each other as many did post-Snowden.
And I think that this is something that our audience needs to very much understand that, you know, not every app that they're using has the encryption protocols that Signal is using. Signal is the only app that actually you have no visibility as to what sort of a communication is happening, right? I mean, I was reading somewhere that Signal can be characterized as the conversation you have with your best friend in your kitchen alone, whilst other apps is the conversation you might be having in a bar and possibly other people might be listening. Is that a fair characterization?
I mean, I think yes, but we need to sort of extend that bar to, you know, the bartender is taking notes. They're then storing those notes in a database. Those notes could be available to the next owner of the bar or could be subpoenaed by governments, and they become kind of indelible records that then give whoever holds those records the authority to interpret them, use them, do whatever they want. And that there is, you know, it's not an accident that Signal and a handful of others are the only ones who are really offering robust privacy. And Signal's the only one that has a sort of large enough network effect to make that practically useful for day-to-day communication. The reason this is not an accident is because surveillance is the business model of networked computation. That's the internet business model. And it's very difficult to monetize these tools that are incredibly expensive to maintain and produce if you don't in some way participate in the surveillance business model. So what we are doing is deeply disincentivized by the norms, practices, and, you know, kind of expectations of the tech industry we exist within.
It sounds like that we all need to be obsessed with encryption and care about our privacy and security. Yet again, one of the things that is happening around the world, especially in the European Union and the United Kingdom, is that we are seeing legislative efforts that are trying to undermine encryption. And they do so in the name of child protection and child safety, which I believe that we all agree is a massive societal problem and we need to resolve it. But it sort of covers the importance of, you know, encryption and privacy, and everybody gets obsessed with fixing the child safety issue. And in the meantime, and in the process, better yet, we are killing encryption and we're undermining privacy and security. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that you've been doing? Because I know that you have been very vocal advocating against the UK's online safety bill and also the work that you're doing in the context of the European Union legislation.
Yeah, well, You know, I'll answer that question first, and then maybe we can get into a little bit of history, because I think it's important to recognize that this fight is not new. This fight kind of crops up very frequently, and to put what we're doing now and what we're facing now in that context. You know, the UK is what I call the tip of the spear of a global attack on encryption and, you know, ultimately a global attack on the right to, you know, private communication, you know, using digital technologies. The UK has a piece of legislation that's actually very much in flux right now, sort of the final stage and the final debate of some amendments that, you know, we are hoping will get into the bill, starts tomorrow. And we're, you know, there's a lot TBD. So when people listen to this episode, they might want to check the latest news, because it's likely there'll be developments we're not able to speak of yet. And hopefully those will be good for everyone. But yeah, you know, back to the point, the UK has a piece of legislation called the Online Safety Bill, which contains a clause that would give their telecom and competition regulator, Ofcom, the power to mandate what's called client-side scanning, which is a, you know, it's a fancy name for, you know, some type of technology that they would mandate is installed on your device that using, you know, some or another means, again, unspecified, would scan, you know, every message you send, likely every message you receive, to assess whether the expression in that message is permitted. And the pretext for this is child exploitation. You know, we don't want people sending child exploitation images or, you know, text that, you know, somehow evokes child exploitation. And to stop this horrible crime, we need to be able to, you know, look into everyone's private communications at all times and make sure there's none of that bad stuff there. I don't think for this audience I need to get into, you know, what a radical departure such a law would be from, you know, even the, I would say, far too permissive norms around surveillance in liberal democracies, and, you know, just how dangerous such a kind of, just how dangerous the magical thinking behind such a proposal is. You know, and the UK, of course, is not the only one where these proposals are being made. The EU has something similar, colloquially called chat controls legislation. And, you know, our perspective, you know, along with the perspective of, you know, the vast, vast, vast majority of the technical community remains the same irrespective of jurisdictions. There's no way to, you know, scan everyone's private communications while preserving human rights. There's no way to scan everyone's private communications without, mm-hmm. you know, fundamentally undermining and nullifying the efficacy of end-to-end encryption. And there's no way to mandate the installation of some janky vendor's app on everyone's device without introducing a significant vulnerability that would not only leave, you know, everyone's communications subject to, you know, scrutiny by hackers, hostile nation states, et cetera, but, you know, could also create a kind of systems level vulnerability. Because, you know, those of us who understand security at this level know that, you know, it often only takes a kind of incidental error in some peripheral software to get you kind of into a system in a way that will give you much more control over many more functionalities. So, you know, this is a very bad idea from almost every angle. And yet it's a kind of, you know, perpetual desire for this sort of wish fulfillment on the part of the security services. And, you know, I would say kind of weaponized, well-meaning others who see a social problem and mischaracterize it as a technological problem and thus, you know, push technological solutions.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think you brought up the importance of history here, and I want to jump back to that because I think that is, you know, one of one of the things that a lot of people don't understand is these debates come back around every few years. That what's happening in the UK is really similar to what has happened. I mean, I over the past again couple of decades, I remember being at conferences circa coming back to like 2013 or so, where the Dutch government was handing out little postcards that literally said, "Think of the children." And I think a lot of people in the security space understand, you know, that has been weaponized so many times. And like Konstantinos and you have both said here, like, child safety is really important. And yet, from my perspective, I see people weaponizing a binary, privacy versus child safety. I see the impact that that has not only on privacy and people's private communications, but also on the right to freedom of expression and other human rights, because we can't organize when we're constantly being spied on. We can't, you know, speak our minds, especially in closed government or closed countries, closed environments, when we're constantly being afraid of being watched. And so, I mean, I guess, you know, I'd love to hear your perspective on more of that history, but I'd also love to hear your thoughts on how advocates like me, like Constantinos, like everyone listening, can better demonstrate that these things don't have to be mutually exclusive. Because right now what I'm seeing is this space where LGBTQ people, sex workers, all sorts of marginalized groups are being put in these crosshairs, and often by, and I am alluding to somebody in particular, but we don't have to get into him at the moment if we don't want to, you know, organizations that seem set out to make a profit on this issue.
Amen. I mean, I think touching on this history, I've actually been doing a lot of reading because that's what I do to sort of auger myself in an analysis, right? And I went back to 1993 to this sort of, you know, this is the beginning of the clipper chip, you know, the clipper chip centric crypto wars that, you know, was basically fighting the concept of key escrow as fundamentally insecure as it was then, so it is now. But there is an op-ed that James Baker, Stuart Baker, who was then the director of the NSA, placed in Wired. And it's like a real, it's a real object lesson in like this extraordinarily cringy kind of boomer snark. Like it's a very, it's a terrible read. But it's, you know, in defense of, you know, effectively backdoors in encryption. And one of the paragraphs in there that struck me, given that 1993 is before, you know, anything we could call the internet, right? The commercial internet is still being negotiated in, you know, kind of regulatory debates and has not, you know, the open web doesn't exist, right? This is proto history. Nonetheless, there is a whole paragraph in there describing how PGP is a tool of pedophiles. Now, no evidence is offered. No, you know, there's nothing there that substantiates that claim. And nor, you know, it's kind of, you're like, how would you know that? And yet it is, you know, all the florid detail you need to just emotionally associate encryption with, you know, child abuse, right? And then there's, you know, there's statements made in congressional testimony a year or so later that sort of, you know, in again, very florid language associate, you know, encryption and PGP with terrorism. So even before, you know, there was any kind of real, you know, even before the internet, even before the ubiquity of these tools, you know, you had this toolbox on the side of the security services, the intelligence services, that was, you know, drawing out these tropes, sort of, you know, citing incredibly emotionally inflammatory language to make the case that, you know, privacy was in fact, you know, the provenance of, you know, the perverse and dangerous. So I think we need to keep in mind that, like, these are well-worn tools, and just, you know, it is very, you know, it's notable that they are deployed across contexts with only, you know, almost no change to the arguments on, you know, on these sort of, you know, for-profit. I mean, I think there is an army of vendors that is lining up to either be the sort of middlemen between, you know, folks reporting, you know, kind of platforms that are being mandated to report such material, to be kind of the clearinghouse for this, and, you know, vendors who are lining up to be, you know, to sell snake oil scanning technologies. And I think we really, you know, as someone who looks at political economy, like, we have to keep our eye on the money and look at, like, you know, how is the money moving in this space, and how is, you know, kind of a desire for profit or, you know, no bid government contracts being valorized by the language of helping children, even though, you know, in my reading, yet we have no evidence of a link between, you know, mass surveillance and a reduction in child harm.
So I listen to you, and I, you know, and I think that, and the thing that goes into my head is, how can we make sure that the average user, and by average user, I always think of my mother that has started to use the internet 3-4 years ago, becomes aware of this, because these practices, we have seen them, and we have seen them in authoritarian countries. We see them in China, for instance. But we're all sitting back and we feel very comfortable when we hear that the UK government or the European Union are about to do this, because we believe that we live in democracies and it's never going to happen in democracies, right? That's our initial reaction to that. Yet again, you know, over the years, and this is one of the things that I am focusing on, when the governments became interested in the internet, we started seeing an attempt to grab more and more power through the internet, right? So I guess what I'm trying to ask is, given that we are at a state that we are, where things are literally at a critical condition, right? I mean, we are seeing that democratic governments want to deploy tools that will allow them for mass surveillance. What can we do as users? What is it that we can do? How can we inform the average user of the dangers that currently we are facing in the internet?
You know, I'm gonna come to that question sideways a bit, because I think one of the reasons that this has been hard, kind of, you know, even speaking out against this, is that it is very unpleasant to be accused of sympathizing with pedophiles, and that the discursive terrain that has been sort of framed by those pushing for surveillance, that this is, you know, surveillance is a tool of child harm, has made it, you know, very difficult for people to want to speak out and clarify the facts, because arguing math versus children is a very difficult argument. And I think it's, you know, I think one of the reasons the army pushing on this has been, you know, stalwart but fairly small for the last few years has been that people don't want to, you know, get caught in those crosshairs. I'm sort of wrestling a little bit, because it's not clear to me that like user education is the lever here, right? I don't think in most cases this is not something people consent to. I thoroughly reject the premise that people don't care about privacy simply because our privacy has been stripped from us by, you know, the platforms we are conscripted to use every day in life if we want to participate in society. I mean, I think there is, you know, I think there's a lot to do to push back at the legislative level. There's a lot to do to sort of clarify the facts around these issues. But, you know, how you make a meaningful discursive intervention is still something I think, you know, we're all working toward. And Jillian, I know you do a lot of writing. There are a number of folks who for years have been making these points. But, you know, I don't think this is a contest of ideas. This is a contest of power, and power, you know, since before the internet, right? We're looking at state statistics. We're looking at, you know, spy agencies. We're looking at Stasi dossiers. We're looking at all of it has like constituted power asymmetry through information asymmetry. So I don't think this fight is ever going away, but we do need to be much more vocal. And I think, you know, one of the reasons we stepped in as Signal was because this is existential for us, right? Like if these laws go into effect and are enacted, we close shop because we're simply not going to adulterate our encryption or, you know, otherwise betray the people who use Signal. So we needed to be vocal, but, you know, I will say it's not a fun debate to enter.
So
sorry.
I know that you really want to ask something, but on that, Meredith, I had read somewhere, and I have seen you writing, that Signal would exit the UK market if the online safety bill were to pass as law with those provisions.
Can I just stop you there?
Yes.
We will not. We never said we'd exit passed as law. And that's an important distinction that gets lost in like BBC headlines. But we've been, you know, and I know this because I've been very specific throughout. We would exit if the choice were between being forced to adulterate our encryption or install one of these, you know, snake oil scanning apps, or exiting. You know, but we will, you know, we're not going to just, you know, take our toys and go home to prove a point, right? There are millions of people in the UK who rely on us. So we will fight to the last minute to make sure they have access to Signal. But what we won't do is undermine our privacy.
Got it. And that was the clarification I wanted. Yeah. Thanks.
Great.
Excellent. I'm also going to go back to something that you said too, which is that this is existential for you. And I think this is just a comment, and I do have another thing to say, which is that, you know, I think that often people in I would say people in more, I don't know what I'm trying to say, democratic societies, let's say, don't really seem to argue for, at least, if not care about privacy until it affects them. And we've seen that. I feel like I've seen that development over the past decade, even among certain marginalized communities that live in democratic nations, that it doesn't really matter until it affects them directly, which is really, really different from what I've seen in other parts of the world that I've worked in. And, you know, I've lived in Germany now for about 9 years, and this is a country where people do deeply care about privacy because at least a generation ago, it was directly experienced by the population. And so I think that that's just such an important part to note. But I do want to jump to something else, which is just to say, we noticed that you took over the Signal Foundation's presidency a year ago tomorrow, which is September 12th. So we wanted to say happy anniversary because we're recording this on September 11th, so that our audience knows. Not intentional for that date, but yeah, so congratulations. And just what are your goals for the next few years for Signal, apart from fighting these battles and keeping the product going?
Yeah, well, I'm so thrilled to be here. And it's sort of, you know, Jillian, you were there. This is sort of a kind of the accidental space that I've been in for a long time. So, yeah, it's been great. And it's been wild because I stepped in, you know, the spy clause in the online safety bill was introduced in September of last year. So this stuff just kicked off. But goals for, you know, for the next few years, I think we're looking, you know, we're a nonprofit, which is actually, you know, as I think I was kind of alluding to earlier, is really important sort of for keeping our eye on privacy, because if we were pressured to, you know, prioritize revenue and growth over privacy, you know, it's likely that we would be pressured to somehow participate in the surveillance business model, because that's, you know, that's how the Valley works. And so being a nonprofit is kind of an important, you know, protection for us that, you know, we're not, you know, if there was an acquisition, I wouldn't be getting rich, right? Like we would have to, you know, give the money back. And there's certain other, you know, just we're able to focus on our mission, not on pleasing venture capitalists or, you know, board members who have a fiduciary duty. So being a nonprofit also means that we are, you know, supported by donations. And one of our primary focuses now is, you know, increasing the number of small donors. We're lucky to have a generous loan from Brian Acton, the WhatsApp co-founder, who's chairman of Signal and kind of guides our progress. But we want to make sure that source of revenue is widely distributed such that we're never facing a, you know, single point of failure. And I think it's also important to emphasize it's really, really expensive to develop and maintain an app like Signal across, you know, all current platforms, or, you know, desktop, iOS, Android, you know, to make sure that, you know, every time there's an iOS update, we're updating, you know, our app to make sure that we're reporting bugs, like all of it, you know, it costs tens of millions of dollars a year. So it's not, you know, the kind of nonprofit model is also like a little ungainly for actually producing high availability tech that meets the standards and expectations of, you know, how tech works, which are expectations set by the surveillance business model and, you know, the large players. But nonetheless, like if we don't meet those, you know, we're relegated to, you know, kind of an interesting tool used among a few Berlin cryptographers, but not something that you can pick up and, you know, use with your mom. And sometimes you need to say something really sensitive to your mom. So, you know, that is not acceptable to us. So, you know, just, I think revenue and, you know, kind of creating a model for small donor driven technology is front of mind for me. As is just sort of growing and cementing the organization. I think we have, you know, we are sort of coming out of a phase of being, you know, incredibly successful, small, you know, almost hacker driven project. That really, you know, a proof of concept that really did prove the concept into a more mature organization and the, you know, really looking thoughtfully and intentionally at like what, you know, what practices do we need to adopt from kind of mid-size organizations in tech and what do we not have to adopt because we actually aren't prioritizing growth over everything. We aren't growth hacking for advertisers. We don't have to, you know, collect surveillance data, monetize that. We're definitely not going down the sort of surveillance artificial intelligence rabbit hole. So, you know, and we can be much, much, much more honest in public about who we are and what we're doing than, you know, organizations who, again, have to privilege revenue and growth over everything else.
Absolutely. No, and it's so awesome. And I'm glad that you brought up the donor model, because that's something that I get friends ask me about all the time. What's that little icon in your Signal profile? Mm-hmm. And as soon as you tell them, like, I'm seeing these little stars and other icons pop up all over my Signal chats. And so it's just really nice to see that model spreading. And I think it's actually done quite elegantly. So for our listeners, if you want to donate to Signal, you just go to your settings. There's a little heart. It says donate to Signal. I think it's like the third thing down. And you click there and you can be a monthly subscriber. I think you can also donate one time. So many ways to do that. But I'm glad that you threw in AI, because I'm going to throw this one over to Konstantinos to ask you. We're going to shift topics now from Signal to your work in AI, if that's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great. Yes. And please, guys, anyone who's listening, donate, because, you know, it's really important that Signal continues to exist and is sustainable. But over to AI, Meredith, Time Magazine, first of all, we need to say that, has named you one of the 100 most influential people in AI for 2023. So huge congratulations.
Thank you.
There is currently a lot of hype over AI. Everyone is talking about it, and most people are actually considering AI to be a doomsday, right? I mean, there is a lot of concern. What are your thoughts about these reactions? Basically, is AI going to take over humanity?
Oh, Lord. I mean, I feel like I'm in a kind of Groundhog Day, because we've had these like AI moments for, you know, almost a decade now, or over a decade. You know, like, it was 2013-ish where you saw, you know, just a quick potted history, because that's how I do. You kind of saw a recognition that old machine learning techniques, convolutional neural nets, and, you know, which date from the late 80s, could do new things and potentially profitable things when matched with huge amounts of computational power and huge amounts of data. Both of those are resources that are concentrated in the hands of a few large corporations and more or less unavailable at that scale to anyone else. So there was really, you know, what I believe is happening since the early, you know, 2010s, and 2012 is kind of an inflection point when there was an important paper published that kind of proved this point. And then you saw this giant acquisition frenzy and kind of AI became everything. And we've seen sort of, you know, mini hype cycles since then. But what was really happening then was not the development of new technology that had astounding properties. It was the rebranding of monopoly power over data and infrastructure as intelligence. And I think we need to keep in mind that AI is primarily a marketing term that's being applied to compute and data-centric statistical models that, yes, have been, you know, different frameworks have been developed, you know, different approaches have been developed, but the fundamental premise remains the same. Bigger is better, and those who have the big infrastructure and the big data are the big companies. Now, what does rebranding this as intelligence do? Rebranding this as intelligence allows them to enter any market they want with it, to claim that their authority and their computational infrastructure are in fact capable of making sensitive decisions, sensitive, you know, predictions of, you know, advising sensitive domains in our political and economic life that, you know, frankly, most tech companies have no idea about, but nonetheless can, you know, use this powerful narrative and the sort of specter of these impressive technologies to kind of infiltrate and, you know, take some form of control over. So that, you know, that's my kind of quick thesis on what AI is, why it's concerning, and what it's doing.
Yeah. I like the way you phrased it, this rebranding of intelligence. I mean, it really hits home, because you're right. I mean, we have seen this over and over again. It's the same as the crypto wars we were discussing, right? These things have the tendency to come over and create this big chaos, and everybody's talking about it. So here we are. So I'm going to throw the next one to Jillian, because it's still on AI, but it's a little bit on, we're moving towards governance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, part of the discussions around AI right now are also around its governance. And again, like, I think this is something where you would probably agree that governance of this has taken a bit of time to catch up to the debates that you've been a part of for a really long time. So recently we saw the UN Secretary General make a call to devise a panel that would advise governments on how to think and to determine future governance of AI. What are your thoughts on this initiative and just in general on how we should be thinking about governance here?
Well, I mean, this is a, I haven't kind of combed through that initiative in any detail, but you know, what I'm looking for is teeth, right? And a lot of, you know, I would say at this moment in history, given, you know, particularly my view from the US, where, you know, our politics are often like 12 corporations in a trench coat and, you know, very, you know, volatile, you know, I would say we are not in a position where, you know, well, to be succinct about it, like OpenAI and others are kind of, you know, running around Congress right now, influencing most debates. And again, we're not seeing a contest of ideas. We're seeing a contest of power, and they have it. I'm not terribly hopeful. I think, you know, again, if we break down AI to its material components, which, you know, infrastructural concentration, you know, the kind of concentration of surveillance data and the, you know, kind of market reach to continually surveil and create new surveillance data, there's sort of, you know, there are levers there that are often not being explored. And there are levers that do not naturalize AI as a technology that is sort of, you know, exists now and will necessarily exist into the future, but actually look at the subcomponents and, you know, apply things like, you know, privacy regulation to the collection and creation of, you know, novel data that would minimize the data flows, that would, you know, minimize the surveillance advertising business model, which is really the engine of a lot of this, you know, both the deployment of, you know, so-called AI and the, you know, collection and creation of the data that AI is fed on, that looks at like structural separation, kind of removing the kind of collated components of, you know, infrastructure, data, et cetera, and kind of carving those up. And I, you know, I would point to the AI Now Institute's landscape report for 2023 that came out in January, I believe, but that's authored by Amba Kok and Sarah Myers West, which goes into some, you know, pretty nuanced analysis for, you know, kind of remediation of some of the, I would say, underlying pathologies that have led us to this, you know, AI moment where, you know, surveillance is being supercharged in the name of, you know, collecting and creating AI data, and AI technologies are being naturalized as intelligent, even as, you know, we have very little evidence they're fit for purpose in most domains.
A quick follow-up on this, Meredith. Do you think that an international legal instrument, whatever that might be, we're not going to go into details, is necessary at this point in time on AI?
I mean, I think that the difference between necessary and possible and effective is pretty important there. I think, you know, we are dealing with, you know, huge tech corporations that in many ways exercise power greater than many nation states, that are, you know, like multinational is a bit of a diplomatic term for the sort of huge and extractive reach of these corporations, that, you know, we have one pool of tech companies in the US and one pool in China. And because of the way the surveillance business model acts as a kind of natural monopoly, there is no meaningful way we would, you know, that I can devise or that we have certainly ever seen for sort of new entrants to that market in any part of the world to sort of emerge naturally. So we're dealing with, you know, massively concentrated, highly unaccountable corporate power based in the US that is sort of extracting and sort of divining, extracting data, extracting resources, and infiltrating these sort of core infrastructures of jurisdictions across the globe. So yeah, there does need to be a non sort of localized jurisdictional approach, but how that works, given the outsized power of the US, given the outsized power of these corporations, given the glassy-eyed dazzlement of most male politicians when faced with the specter of AI, is really unclear to me. I mean, I, you know, when I point to solutions, it's less like a global governance body and more like the Writers Guild of America strike or the SAG strike, which are actually saying like, no, this is hurting us now. Absolutely not. We're withdrawing our labor, classic solution. And we're saying we're not waiting for you to constitute a panel that will have Sam Altman at the helm to decide 3 years from now what our fates are. We're actually taking it into our own hands and we're fighting.
Good. I like that. Now it's my favorite part, but I will let Jillian ask my favorite part of the podcast.
I mean, unless you really, do you want to ask it? You can ask it.
No, please go ahead.
All right. So now that we're coming to a close, I'm going to throw our favorite and the question that we ask all of our guests to you, which is that given that our podcast is called the Internet of Humans, what is your favorite internet and human experience?
What is my favorite internet and human experience? Well, I'm going to be like, the first thing that comes to my mind is Google Reader. Do you all remember Google Reader?
Yeah.
I miss it every day, honestly.
I miss it every day. I have a whole striated collection of theories about how we wouldn't be in this hellhole if Google Reader still existed, because it was such a great place for like meaningful education and communication with people who actually knew their stuff. And it sustained a really, really rigorous ecosystem of, you know, blogs and expertise that was outside of mainstream media, but still had kind of a peer review capacity, because the people who were genuinely experts and genuinely interested were sort of in the comments and community of those things. So I, you know, Google Reader was hugely important to me. I still have friends from Google Reader. I still stay at their houses when I travel. And it was also a place like, for me, it was like the social network where it wasn't based on your photos. Yes. It was like, I would get to know people through their ideas, through their rhetoric, through, you know, how they spent time educating other people about their expertise. And I miss it every single day. And it's really the model for like the internet we lost to me.
I completely agree. I mean, just to quickly add to that, I used it heavily as a writer for Global Voices, which I volunteered for over a decade and still stay in touch with. That was how I found all of the things that I would, you know, use that I would curate for the posts that I was writing. And I really do feel like we just lost so much with its departure. So thank you for bringing that back to us and to our listeners.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Please revive Google Reader, Google.
Bring it back.
We know, like, just a few GPUs on that and not on Bard would be great.
And on, I think we all can agree on that. And on that note, I think we have to come to a close. Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a really, really special episode. And it's just great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Meredith.
Thank you for doing the work for so long. I really appreciate you both.
Thank you so very much for being here. We really appreciate it. Thanks.
Great.